Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest tonight is Harvard University fellow Adam Tanner, whose new book, What Stays in Vegas, looks at how casinos and other businesses gather information about each of us in order to help them make more money off of us. We'll be talking to Adam Tanner in a few minutes. In the news, Richard, in Ohio, they agreed to use pre-shuffled cards in blackjack and baccarat games. This will save time shuffling, but last year the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City lost $1.5 million using pre-shuffled cards in baccarat. How do you think it's different this time?
Well, I don't think it's different. A lot of casinos have gone to this because, as you say, it's a great time-saving measure. It seems to me that it will, you know, on rare occasions, provide an opportunity for Advantage players. You know, I don't much fear it in the United States, but, you know, when I've played in foreign casinos, I was always a little bit concerned about not being able to see all the cards spread on the table before playing.
They might take out a few aces or something. They might take out a few aces or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that happened to me once in Korea where they brought in new cards and I said, you know, she just was going to start shuffling the shoe. And I said, wait, spread the cards on the table. And she started to spread them, and it looked like ace, two, three, four, 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 five, five, five. And immediately they scooped them back up and said, it was a mistake. You know, yeah, it was a mistake. So I wouldn't be worried about it too much in the United States. In foreign countries, especially, you know, smaller casinos, it would concern me. So, but the case in Atlantic City with the Golden Nugget, you know, some Advantage players may find some opportunities with these pre-shuffled cards.
Well, the difference I see is in Atlantic City, once the card company, Jamaco in that case, had decided on their special order, maybe King of Diamonds and then Queen of Hearts and then Jack of something and King of Spades and et cetera, whatever it was, they had that same order for every deck they produced. So once you had that order memorized, you could do great things with it. Now, in this new system, it's a different card manufacturer they're using. Every deck is different. And so that makes it a huge difference.
Huh. I had never heard that about that Jamaco. I don't understand how they would all come out in exactly the same order. But, boy, if that was the case, I'm surprised more people didn't whack it.
Well, all right. Another in the news. At a casino in London, two professional poker players are accused of cheating against a Dubai-based trader. Although we don't know the details of this and aren't publicizing the names of the accused, the expert witness in this case is none other than Richard Marcus. He's a self-professed casino cheat who's been on our show 3 times. Presumably, Marcus stands up in court and testifies that, yes, he cheated casinos and other players for millions of dollars, but he's telling the truth this time. Do you think he'll be a credible witness, Richard?
You know, I'm sure he will get shredded by the attorney on the other side. But he's been on our show 3 times, but I think we've only aired 2 of them. The one about cheating at poker specifically, I think we still have in the can. So we'll be airing that sometime in the near future. You know, the one thing I would say, though, is I have a friend who had a case where he was accused of cheating, and there was an expert witness hired by the other side when he sued the casino, And, you know, pretty clearly the guy who was hired as an expert witness for the other side was basically just a whore, you know, taking the money, because it was pretty clear that my friend was not cheating. And, you know, if you pay somebody enough, they'll say whatever you want them to say. You know, sort of like scientists who will say that smoking doesn't cause cancer, right? So I don't, even though I was just an expert witness on a case this year, I don't,
you know,
have a lot of faith.
All right.
But it'll be interesting to see. I mean, a lot of the poker players have said that this guy who lost the money was a really terrible player and people wouldn't need to cheat him. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, just because you don't need to doesn't mean that you don't want that extra.
Well, but, that's true.
All right. Yep. Different subject. You're starting your own project of sorts called What Happens in Vegas. What's that all about?
Yeah, you know, I was always sort of fascinated by the ad campaign, What Happens in Vegas Stays in Vegas. And I thought, boy, you know, I'd love to hear some of those stories. You know, maybe they shouldn't stay in Vegas. So, yeah, I'm going to start a new podcast series where I'm hoping that I will get people to tell me their stories about the craziest, wackiest things that happened to them while they were in Las Vegas. Not necessarily just gambling stories, but any kind of stories that are really unusual. So I have two criteria. The story has to be true, and it has to happen. It has to have happened to the actual person telling it. I don't want to get a friend of a friend had this happen. You know, you know, people who, if anybody has, any of our listeners has a really crazy Vegas story, just shoot me an email and I'll arrange to interview them over Skype. It's audio only, so you don't have to worry about your face being seen or your identity if you don't want it known. So
if I made it with a hooker in the backseat of a taxi cab, you want to hear about this?
Yeah, although
this is hypothetical, never happened.
That is a bunch of a story. I think it'd have to get crazier than that.
Oh, that's already more crazy.
I'm looking for the really out there stories.
That's more crazy than I've ever been. So, all right, maybe I'm not your guy. Let's talk to our guest. Adam Tanner is a fellow at the Institute of Quantitative Social Science at Harvard University. He's worked for Reuters in several locations around the world, including Berlin, Serbia, Moscow, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C. He regularly contributes to Forbes magazine. Adam Tanner, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Nice to be with you this evening.
All right. Thank you for being here. Your book, What Stays in Vegas, The World of Personal Data, Lifeblood of Big Business, and the End of Privacy as We Know It, covers a lot of ways various organizations capture and use data about us for their own benefit. While casinos aren't the only businesses discussed in your book, this show is about gambling, so we're going to concentrate mostly on the casino angle. In many ways, your book is a case study of how Total Rewards works. This player tracking system used by Caesars Entertainment, formerly known as Harrah's, it captures data and then extends offers to players, hoping to make more money off these players than the casino spends on offers. Before going into how they did this, I would expect Caesars to be rather secretive about many of the things they do. How did you talk them into sharing such a large amount of information with you?
So at the beginning of this project, which began about 2 years ago, I went to go see the CEO of Caesars, which is Gary Loveman, and we'll, I imagine, talk about him in the coming minutes.
Uh-huh.
And I explained to him that I wanted to understand how the program works behind the scenes, how the gathering of data happens, who gathers the data, what do they do with it, and what impact does it have on the players, to bring the story to life in a human way. And he agreed to do that. And I think the reason really is that when you agree to share your data, as you do in a program such as Total Rewards or perhaps in a frequent flyer program or whatever, you have to trust that the company that you're sharing the data with is making good use of it, is not using it against you, but is using it in some way that's going to benefit you. And I think he believed that transparency on this was going to help the players feel more at ease about the whole program.
Did you know Gary Loveman from Harvard prior to this? Or
I didn't, but I think you know, he was a junior business professor here years before I was here, but he worked on case studies. He wrote many case studies while he was here, as many business professors do, which are studies of individual businesses and how they fare in different junctures and different challenges. So I think he understood what it's all about to research and write in a lively way about a business. So I think that made him more sympathetic to a project such as this.
Now, speaking of Loveman, he's a number cruncher. He's a mathematical nerd of sorts who's now in charge of the world's biggest casino company. Now, what has been his contribution to the way Harrah's has evolved over the last 15 or so years?
Well, as you mentioned, he's quite a different kind of casino leader than many in the past in Las Vegas. He's someone who has a PhD, who went to MIT and got his doctorate there, and then he became a very popular professor at Harvard Business School. While he was at Harvard Business School, he began to do consulting. The way the program works there is professors are allowed to spend one day a week consulting to outside companies, and Harrah's turned to him for some insights to how to improve their business and how to make people less promiscuous going from one casino to the other. How do you get the casinos? How do you become loyal to any one casino? What's going to keep you there rather than going across the street every time your luck runs bad? So he was studying this problem, and his big insight that drew a lot of attention while he was an academic was this concept of lifetime value of a customer. So if you go to a pizzeria and you buy a pizza for $1 or $2, you're not that valuable to the pizzeria. They don't make that much money off of you. But if you go the whole time, it might be worth $7,000 or $8,000. And if you buy the same kind of you buy the same car,
Adam,
from
Adam,
the
excuse
same
me.
Manufacturer, different cars from the same manufacturer over the years.
Adam, for whatever reason, your number is breaking up, so my producer is going to call you back and we'll see if we can get a better connection. Meanwhile, Richard and I are going to talk about something else for about 2 minutes while we get that connection going again. All right. Richard, there were two players in this year's on Hall of Fame ballot, Ted Forrest and Mike Mattisau, who made a significant weight loss bet. Apparently, Ted Forrest agreed to lose 43 pounds without surgery, amputation, or drugs. And he did. Mattisau owed something like $2 million and is stalling paying. What's your take on this?
You know, I think we could do an entire show about weight loss bets, especially on poker players. I mean, I remember Doyle Brunson has had numerous weight loss bets over the years. And I remember around the time I was interviewing him for my book, you know, he was considering having a leg amputated, I think, to win a weight loss bet. But, you know, let's see, how do I put this in a politically correct manner? There are a lot of poker players who are today a winner, tomorrow no dinner. And, you know, if I was going to make a bet with one of those poker players, boy, I'd want the money posted up front, you know.
So you got to be careful who you bet with.
Not only careful who you bet with, but, yeah, like I said, I'd want the money posted up front. But
all right. Very good. So we have a reconnection with Adam Tanner. He was telling us how Gary Loveman's approach to management is different than other casino executives. So continue, please, Adam.
So, I mean, I was quickly mentioning that he, you know, he had a background in, you know, as a PhD at MIT, he was teaching at Harvard Business School, and then he got into this concept, or he became fairly well known for this concept of lifetime value of customers, to try to get you to keep going to the same business year after year, because your business for a casino at one night is fine, but it's inconsequential compared to what you could be worth over a long period of time. And the problem traditionally with casinos has been that many players are promiscuous. They go from one casino to another without any loyalty to one. And so he studied ways into preserving loyalty so that you would keep coming back to the same casino. And that's why he first was consulting for Harrah's, then became the chief marketing officer, then became the CEO on this concept, and he's been very successful in implementing it there.
And the idea is that this total rewards program keeps the customers loyal?
So the total rewards program serves to keep them loyal by giving you a lot of benefits for joining the program and also identifying who are the valuable customers. So some of the insights they gained are that in the olden days, there was a lot of sizing up customers just based on what they thought you were worth, what kind of the sense they had about you, and you've probably, on your program over the years have talked about some of the classic characters in Las Vegas who would come up to you, shake your hand, talk to you for a few minutes, and just hand you a ticket for a free meal or something because they liked your style. Now it's all based on kind of the math, the statistics of how valuable you've been as a client over the years. And they discovered certain things that they, in the olden days, for example, a player who came every week and spent $80 or $100 might not have been considered very important, not a VIP. But if you do the math and multiply that by 50 weeks or 52 weeks, that's a pretty important player. And so those people began getting rewards in a way that they hadn't before when the loyalty programs came online. And that would probably be some of your people listening on who are in the local market who like to go on a frequent basis. And so the loyalty program, the total rewards, began to see those people as important clients, as well as the flashier players that came and spent a big amount of money on fewer occasions.
So speaking of Gary Loveman, there's a story in your book about information he learned in an elevator that made him change his slot machines. What was that all about?
So this was an interesting one. A lot of the work that they do has to do with pure statistics and numbers and so on. And this was sort of a tip-off he got just by he was riding in the Harrah's Hotel there on the Strip, and there was an elderly couple that was riding with him that he did not know, but he was overhearing as they were speaking. And they were grumbling about what poor luck they had had in recent days in Las Vegas. And they said, look, we just hate it here. This is a terrible place. The slot machines are so tight. And so Gary Loveman started talking to them, and he asked, where are you from, and so on. And they explained that they're from Atlantic City, and in Atlantic City they had much more luck with slot machines. But Gary Loveman knew that at that time, the slot machines in Las Vegas were actually had better odds for the players than they did in Atlantic City. So he from that had the suspicion, well, maybe players cannot tell whatsoever if a slot machine is loose or not. And so what he did was he did a series of tests. He hired mathematicians at his old alma mater, MIT, to run tests whether people could tell over the long cycle that modern slot machines have, which are millions of spins, whether there was any way to tell if the hold was 5 or 8 or 10%, would you be able to tell the difference between a looser machine and a tighter machine? And he found they couldn't. And so he then did a test on the floor of one of the casinos and had a group of machines that was looser than the other in terms of slot machines, giving out more money. And the players did not flock to the better odds machines. They couldn't tell the difference. And so he changed the odds. And so over the years, if you look at the statistics, many other casinos have also followed in that direction. And so the slot hold over the years has become, I mean, it fluctuates a little bit from year to year, but has become less generous than in the time when he rode the elevator and had this insight.
Boy, that is really contrary to the conventional wisdom in Las Vegas. Because, and I'm not saying they're right, I mean, because, you know, there's a lot of wrong conventional wisdom, but you know, for 30 years, I've been hearing that the players will identify the looser machines. And even if it's tucked in the back corner of the casino, eventually the players just intuitively realize that their money is lasting them longer on some machines than others. But you're saying they actually did studies and determined that the players could not determine this.
They could not. It was just a sense that people had. But the cycle of a modern machine goes over millions of spins, and over millions of spins, there can certainly be a luck that runs in certain ways. I mean, for example, if you flipped a coin 50 times, it might come out 40 times heads, and you would think, oh, this coin is more likely to spin heads than tails. But if you keep going on into thousands of spins, into hundreds of thousands of spins, and so on, eventually you're gonna reach the true mathematical odds, which are 50-50. And so people may think that they can tell the difference, but what they found in the studies and what they have since done was quite the difference. And in fact, when he introduced this change, there was resistance even from his company. A lot of people said, no, we have to advertise that we have loose slots. And they were about to run a campaign saying, we have very loose slots, please come to our casinos. But they decided to go in this other direction, and they've been very successful in doing that. And as I said, a lot of other casinos,
well,
you can look,
they're very successful, but, I mean, aren't they $30 billion in debt?
They're very successful in terms of drawing people to those slot machines. The debt issue is sort of a very different problem, having to do with the financing of the company and the sailing of the company. I'm speaking specifically about drawing in customers and being successful in their marketing and in their, you know, in drawing people's loyalty over time.
Mm. Now, I'm a video poker player at Caesars, among other places, and I've willingly signed up for Total Rewards because I like the benefits that I get. Now, in general, rather than my case in specific, how much does Caesars know about me, and how much of the information they have about me was gathered without my knowledge?
So traditionally, the Caesars in particular has only gathered information about you from the casino itself. Although this has changed somewhat, and this is something that in my book, What Stays in Vegas, I talk about. And that means that pretty much in all the gambling transactions you do, you will hand in your loyalty card because you want to have the rewards that come from that.
Correct.
And so on the machines, they know to the penny what you've spent. On the tables, they estimate as best they can. You're probably going to hand in the card when you have meals there, and you may save a dollar or two on each entree. They're going to know what shows you like. They're going to know pretty much everything that happens in the public space. That means that they don't know what happens inside the hotel rooms themselves. But everything else they track, and then they'll know that you may like Chinese food rather than some other kind of food. They may know what kind of entertainment you like. And hopefully they're tailoring that to make your experience better and more enjoyable. Now, some casinos have experimented with getting outside data to try to market to you. So in one case, for example, that I came across, Wynn's was buying public information from the Marriage Records Bureau there in Las Vegas. And people who were getting married, they bought these records, which would include their name and contact numbers and addresses and so on. And about 6 months after the marriage, they would send them an offer and say, please come back to Las Vegas, celebrate your first-year anniversary by staying at our hotel. So some other casinos have looked at this data to try to market to you. And over time, Caesars was a bit resistant, or quite resistant over the years, to using outside data. But that resistance has eased up as it's become pretty commonplace in businesses all over the place that you can buy supplementary data and know even more about people.
So Bob, as he mentioned, is very geared into that system. I, on the other hand, value my privacy a lot more. Now, in the old days, first of all, the casinos would never call you by your name. They would call you Mr. C or Mr. A or whatever. And they recognized that a lot of people who gamble want to maintain their privacy. So why have they insisted that you give them your real ID? Why won't they allow you to get a player's card in a John Doe, right? I mean, you're still a valuable player. Do they just not value you if you're unwilling to give up your real name?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing about the casino model is that you do have a choice. So if Bob is happy to give up his information and is glad to get the free meals and the other perks that he may accrue, the data will be gathered on him, and he has that choice. If you, on the other hand, prefer not to give up that data, you can play with cash at the table. They won't know who you are, and you can gamble anonymously. interestingly, unlike a lot of businesses, the data that they collect about you actually stays in Vegas or stays in their servers in the company. This is not something that is sold to other companies. And on the internet, a lot of the other business you do, that kind of information about you is sold to other companies. But I guess in terms of marketing, if you're just John Doe, they don't know really who you are, where you are. They want to actually be able to send you offers to a real person. And so that's why they need the real name.
Did they tell you a percentage, what percentage of people that play at Harrah's use a player's card and what percentage just would rather play without one?
Apparently, the overwhelming majority of players join the loyalty program, join Total Rewards. Now, it's hard to have an exact statistic on this because they don't count, they don't know exactly how many people do not join, but their indication is that the overwhelming majority of people do join the program, and only a small minority decide that their privacy is worth more or they just don't care about joining the program.
Hmm. Let's look at facial recognition. In theory, a casino could have two lists of players, one list of their VIPs, and one list of the players they consider undesirable for one reason or another. Now, with accurate facial recognition software, players from both lists could be identified as soon as they enter the property and perhaps even as soon as they get into the parking lot. How accurate is facial recognition software today? And using your crystal ball, how accurate do you think it's going to be in 5 years?
So in researching my book, I did spend some time with some of the security officers and spent them in the security rooms talking to them about this very issue, about facial recognition and modern advances in surveillance. The problem right now that there is still inconsistencies in the way facial recognition works, and they have a high degree of false positives, which means that they suspect that someone is someone they're looking for, and it's the wrong person. And sometimes it's a very obvious bad match. So they might be looking for a white male, and a black woman comes up, and it's just patently not the right person.
Could be good makeup.
So when they're looking for criminals or whatever they're looking for as a security measure, having false positives, people that they're looking at a second time to make sure they're not those people, perhaps that's worthwhile. But if you, in the scenario that you're talking about, the VIPs coming in and using facial recognition software, if you have a very high level of false results, you might be rolling out the red carpet for a lot of wrong people, or maybe not rolling out the right red carpet for the right people. So I think right now the casinos are not using this. The traditional ways are much better. A lot of the VIPs will be pre-announced. If they're very important players that might be met at the airport with a limousine and driven in, or as soon as they walk in, they hand in their cards. And so far, Caesars in particular has found it quite useful to rely on these old methods rather than facial recognition. Now, it may change over the years, but part of the other problem is that the lighting conditions, how the photos are taken and so on, determine how accurate the facial recognition software is. So there's a lot of darker corners in casinos. There's a lot of twists and turns and cameras at different angles. Now, it's interesting, though, that there are a lot of cameras. There's something like 3,000 cameras in some of the big casinos, maybe as many as 5,000 cameras. And they're looking not only at the clients, at the customers, but at the staff as well. They're looking at both sides of the shop.
Some of the casinos have actually gone to, thumbprint readers on the, on the slot machines. And, I think 5 years from now, your chance of being, totally anonymous is going to be really difficult. They're going to a cashless system, if possible. You'll have credit at the casino and you'll stick your thumb on a reader and your credits will appear on the machine,
But that would create a market opportunity for those people who want more anonymity. Maybe some other casinos will specialize in that, and then you'll go there instead. So I think it would be surprising if everyone went in that direction, because there are still going to be players who don't want to give away their thumbprint or give away all that kind of information, such as you suggested about yourself.
Yep.
many people are on Facebook and other forms of social media. Is there any information found on Facebook that would be useful to a casino marketing department?
So there's a huge amount of information on Facebook that's useful to a casino marketing department and lots of other companies. And this is kind of a very interesting area where the lines are sort of blurred as to what is okay and what to do, because all this kind of vast amount of accumulation of data about us all in the casino world as well as all the economy beyond, it's all new stuff developing in recent decades, and the lines and the rules are not exactly set. And so people are cautiously finding their way. The businesses are trying to figure out what are the best practices. Now, with Facebook, for example, there's a lot of programs where you can sign into the website, for example, using your Facebook profile. But when you do that, you're sharing your whole Facebook identity and information about you with the casino. And often, in the broader sense, what you do on Facebook and who you associate with can tell people a lot about you. And there's been studies, for example, that show by knowing who your contacts and friends are on Facebook, what your social network is, could reveal your sexual preference. That if you have a certain number of gay friends but say nothing about yourself, you are likely gay. Or depending on what your likes are, sexual preference might be discernible. That's just based on kind of mathematical patterns, right? So, you know, that information could be useful to marketing certain kinds of shows and events and parties and so on. But on the other hand, certain people might be taken aback if you were specifically marketed just based on that information. So I think that's stuff that the casinos are approaching rather cautiously. Now, Facebook has also been used by some of the security people, and I don't know if you talk on your show about the Tony Ahn case. Is that something you're familiar with?
I'm not familiar with it.
So this was a guy who worked in one of the casinos, what happened was, at one point, a security guard noticed someone had a cigarette pack with 21 sort of player loyalty cards, and the person was cycling through all of these cards, and they were basically loyalty reward points at a different casino chain. What it turned out to be was the way they broke the case was as follows. This guy who had 21 cards, he was charged with illegally using too many loyalty cards, and they didn't really know much about him. He was someone they had never seen before. He had no record with casinos and so on. But the person who bailed him out of jail, they looked up his Facebook profile, and on that Facebook profile, they linked him to this man called Tony Ahn, who was an employee at one of the casinos, part of the MGM chain. And he was in the loyalty rewards program. He was able to turn over points that were about to expire, kind of rewards points, just a few weeks before they expired. He would put them on these cards and then sent out friends and associates to go spend them. And so in this case, there's an example of how Facebook helped them crack the case, because it wasn't the main guy but the friend of the friend, and then through the social networking that was indicated, they were able to find a whole bunch of people who were involved in the scheme.
So one of the lessons to learn from this is never bail out anybody from jail.
You can you could draw the lesson, never put anything on Facebook, or never bail anyone out from jail, or never engage in any stuff that's criminal, or whatever. There's a whole bunch of variants on that you could think of.
Right. Well, certainly for anybody, who uses Facebook should at the very least, make it a private, don't make your Facebook page open to the public.
Yes. But as I said, but then if it wasn't open to the public and you used it to log on to whatever internet program you use or different sites that you're visiting, just because that's quite convenient, then you share that information. And so a lot of this stuff seems to be private, and then they change the rules, or then you log in or you do something, and then the information is shared with others.
Right.
Now, in the data collection business, who are people who are gathering information off of Facebook or other places, there's some shady operators. you talk about some of the shady operators in your book. Tell us about one or two of the more interesting ones.
So information is gathered by data brokers about us all. And there are data brokers that have hundreds of millions of files with many points of information about us, where we live, who our associates are, who our relatives are, what we buy, whether we are sports lovers or gun lovers, or what are our preferences in all sorts of different things. And they use that for marketing purposes. But there are marketers that press the limits as to what kind of information they use. So for one category, for example, would be medical information. So I would go off to, in fact, I was in Las Vegas, and there was the annual Direct Marketing Association convention 2 years ago. And I would go from table to table and explore what the different offerings were. And I was surprised by one, which, for example, was men who suffer from erectile dysfunction. And I asked them, oh, this is quite interesting. How do you have this information? And this was a list of more than a million men who suffered from this, with their name, their address, and phone number, various contacts for them. And they said that these men had had volunteered their information. Now, it's not clear.
That's likely.
I said, this is a little surprising, but may I buy 100 or 1,000 names from you? And I just want to send them an email or a letter with the following question. Did you know that you were on this list? And have you received offers that you think are useful from being on this list? But they told me that that would be an immoral use of their data. So I was not able to find out the answer to that question. I mean, there's other lists that could make some people uncomfortable. And for example, I came across a list of several hundred thousand high school students who are gay. And this information is specifically by name, address, and so on. And it's information that is often gathered in ways that the people giving it away don't totally understand what's going on. And in this case, it's students who are looking for college scholarships, and they volunteer a lot of information hoping to find scholarships that are well suited for them or targeted to them in some way. But then that information about them is sold. Now, marketers across the spectrum, whether it's in casinos or whatever the product is, could use these kind of information to market to. But again, this is the kind of thing that a lot of people would be uncomfortable about, and it gives should give you a little cause to think before you share data. Just keep in mind that it's going to be out there forever, and it may be used again and again if you don't otherwise know that they keep it there. And as I pointed out before, though, the contrast with casino data, so the loyalty program data that you give up in casinos, that's kept by the company, as in the case of Caesars that I mentioned. So that's different than a lot of other companies which are sharing or renting the data to others.
For now. But, I mean, isn't Caesars talking about breaking off their loyalty program or selling it off or something? Wasn't there some recent talk about that?
They've told people that there's very complicated corporate restructuring stuff because of the large debt and because of those issues. That's not exactly what I'm focusing on in the book. I'm focusing on the gathering of data, what they do with it, what impact it has on you and I. But they have said throughout the history of the program that they will not share the data and give it over to others. They'll keep it as a protected asset. So.
Right, but if they did sell it to a different entity, the new entity could then decide to do something different with it. The reason I'm asking about this is Ken Adams had a recent editorial within the last week or so asking what is their database of 35 million names worth? And he didn't have an answer to that, but did Gary Loveman have something he thought that it was worth?
I've never heard a number about that, but I mean, it's often considered sort of their greatest asset. Sort of, they have not, they may not have the singing gondoliers and the dancing fountains and some of the spectacular most modern hotels on the Strip, but they have this great database and great experience in studying statistics and data analytics and so on, and that's what has made them very successful over the years and has made them into the largest casino company. So they've always said that they will keep this data preserved and pure and not be shared with outsiders. So that's what they've always said.
Our radio show uses a Gmail email address, namely gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. This email address is free, but if you use it, you give up a certain amount of privacy protection. Now, if we didn't want to give up that privacy protection, what email should we use?
So a Gmail account, it's like a lot of things on the internet today. It's a product that's free, and in exchange for that free product, you're giving up information that they will use to then market to you. So in the case of a Gmail account, a machine will comb through the keywords and place advertising. So for example, if your readers are asking you about video poker, they might notice those words and then put ads for video poker on the screen somewhere. So that's the equation. And again, Facebook is another example of a service that's free, but they're looking at the kind of data that you have out there, the kind of preferences and likes you have, and they'll place advertising and offers based on that. So if you want to have more privacy than that, you have to pay for the service. And there's all different gradations of services that you can have. There's a whole appendix in the book, In What Stays in Vegas, that explains some of the things you can do to beef up your privacy. I mean, there are services that send emails that are encrypted so that they can't be easily intercepted. When I send from here in the Boston area to you in Las Vegas, anyone along on the way could not make sense of what I'm sending you. There's other ways to do that. You saw the, it's sort of related, not exactly what your question was, but just recently there was this leakage of photos related to celebrities such as Jennifer Lawrence that came out of apparently the iCloud. And so this was stuff that had not been as secure as it might have been. Now, there are encrypted ways to store your stuff in the cloud. Oftentimes, doing these more secure private things involve more effort and more hassle than the easiest products to do. So you have to decide how much convenience do you want and how much effort do you want to store it up. And in some cases, it might just be more convenient to have two, like the easy one that you use most of the time, and then a second email address that would be for more sensitive matters that's a bit more protected.
There is a free service called Hushmail, which I believe is pretty well protected, and that is free.
Right. There are some of those free services where they have limited versions, and then there's a fuller thing. A lot of those are freemium models where they give you some of the product, and you're hoping that you're so impressed by it that you'll buy more storage with them or something more. But, yeah, there's a lot of different products. I mean, we saw with the whole Edward Snowden thing that there's services that are strengthened security, but could still be broken if someone had incredible resources and incredible desire to break into them.
If you knew somebody's birthday, sex, and zip code, what are the chances a specialist could use that information and get their actual name, their social security number, marital status, how much money in the bank, blah, blah, blah?
So, interestingly, as you put lots of little pieces of information into a machine, into a computer, things that seem really obscure and useless in the abstract are quite useful in figuring out who you are. And it's sort of like a mosaic. If you have a single stone from a mosaic, you can't really tell what the image is. And a few stones you might not be able to tell, but eventually the picture comes into focus as you add more and more. Or if you think of letters on a game with Vanna White turning over a few letters and more, you'll be able to see or make out what the word is, even with a lot of pieces of information missing. So it turns out that your exact birth date and year of birth, sex, and zip code are three pieces of information that can identify something like 87% of the United States. And there's a couple of pages in the book where I try out this finding by a colleague of mine here at the university. And I was looking for three people who were in a medical experiment called the Personal Genome Project, where they gave all of their medical history and put it on the internet, and they shared their genome for science. But they also put up there their email address. Their birth date, sex, and zip code. And just with those three pieces of information, I found three people that I was looking for that had very intimate medical histories. That had abortions, had used drugs. One had been abused as a child. All that information was out there about them, and then I found them. So I called them up and talk to them, and a bit of their stories are in the book. So stuff that seems innocent often is the vital piece of information that can identify you. It's an interesting thing also that often when you're shopping and you go to the clerk and you're buying something and you pay with a credit card and they say, oh, can I have your zip code, please? That's actually a way to find out more information about you, because when they have your zip code and your name, that can determine that you're Bob Smith in this town rather than Bob Smith from another town, and that they can match that with other database or data broker information. The one exception to this, by the way, is that if you're buying gas with a credit card, or it's something that they do need for verification because there's no human there checking it out. But if there's a human there and asking you for the zip code, it's typically, or it's often, for just gathering more information about you.
All right. So I've read that the MGM Properties has this program that links you to other people. So, for example, if I'm playing at a dealer's table, they have a program that if, let's say that the dealer was actually my cousin, this program would turn that up. It looks for links between people. And so they use it. One thing they use it for is, you know, weeding out, you know, cheating or things like that. Did you look into any of that?
So I don't know about that program in specific, but MGM is the company that using Facebook and using social connections was able to uncover the crime that I mentioned before of the false use of points. So, and again, it sounds like something that could be a good beneficial program, or it could be something used against you. I mean, they could also tell you, hey, you don't know, but, you know, some of your friends are in town and you didn't know it, or it could be used in some way that may be something that you like or appreciate, or something you could opt into as a service, right? But it certainly sounds credible that it could be something used to find out associations or to prevent some of the things we're talking about before, some of the insider playing and so on.
Mm-hmm. We've been talking to Adam Tanner, author of the new book, What Stays in Vegas. Adam, if someone wished to get in touch with you, what would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, I have a Twitter handle, which is Data Curtain. I have a website about the book, which is whatstaysinvegas.us. And if you send an email, it would be book@whatstaysinvegas.us.
Thank you very much. This was very informative, and it was scary as to what some of the casinos are gathering. We actually just scratched what the book was about in this interview. I recommend the book to our listeners. Adam Tanner, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. So let's talk about our sponsors a bit, and then Richard and I can discuss how much we learned tonight in the time we have left. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. That's more than anybody else has. In September, every night at 8:15, they draw 16 names, one of which receives $10,000 and the other 15 receive $500 each. The first name, if they're there within 4 minutes, they collect $10,000. If that person is not there, it goes on the list of the 15 people who collect $500. These folks have 24 hours to collect their money, or it's forfeited. At slots, $1 earns 3 entries. At video poker, $1 earns 1 entry. There's a maximum of 10,000 entries per day. At 9 p.m., they empty the barrel, and you may start to earn tickets towards tomorrow night's drawing. This coming Wednesday, the free video poker class is double-double bonus quick quads. This is the game that I play most at South Point. In addition to returning 99.65% before you include the slot club and other benefits, the game is interesting and fun. The class is held at the Grandview Lounge, begins at noon, and this week will last until about 3:30. At the Palms, they have drawings every Friday night. 10 winners share $10,000 each Friday. You earn 5 time entries Friday and Saturday night, 8 to midnight. 2 times entries all day, Sundays and Tuesdays. You do not have to be present at the drawing to win, but you do need to claim your prize before midnight or you forfeit. Any player who enters the Friday drawing prior to 6:45 p.m. on gets $10 in free play on Saturday. PFP, play for points, Monday through Friday. From now until September 26th, the prizes are Chevron gas cards up to a maximum of 200 per day. The cards are earned at a rate of 0.25% for video poker, 2% for slots. Another way of saying this is it takes 4,000 video poker points or 5,000 slot points to earn $100 in free play. You keep your points. Points accumulate through the two-week period. For example, if you earned 160,000 points tomorrow, that's going to entitle you to $400 in free play, $400 in Chevron cards, but there's a $200 daily limit. So you could collect 200 tomorrow, and someday next week you could come in and collect the other $200. VideoPoker.com remains the best place to practice a very wide variety of games, including Quick Quads, Ultimate X, Extra Draw Frenzy Poker, Hyper Bonus, many others. Often these games are the best ones in a casino, and you need practice to make sure you know. The weekly game this week is Multi-Strike. This is a four-line game. You pay for all four lines at once, up front, and play the bottom line. If you get at least your money back on the bottom line, you get to play the second line up, level two, at double the rewards. If you get both the bottom two lines, you play the level three at four times rewards, and then level four at eight times the rewards. Periodically receive free rides, which allow you to move up to the next level when you score on the current level. The game requires four different strategies. One at each level, because moving up on levels is valuable. At the lower levels, you go for the sure thing more than you go for them at the higher levels. On Wednesday, October 1st, I'll be teaching Jacks Are Better Multi-Strike at the South Point. All right, Munchkin, we got about a minute and a half or so to go. What did we learn anything tonight, or what do we got?
Well, yeah, I mean, as you said, I mean, it's scary how much they know. It's hard to protect yourself, and I think the future, unfortunately, is rather bleak. I mean, I don't think you'll be able to play anonymously for too many more years, you know?
There are several chapters or several sections in the book of how to protect yourself, and it gives a lot of things to do and not do if you want to keep some of your information to yourself.
Can you give us just a couple of the highlights?
It has tells you which email addresses to use, which we talked about briefly. It suggests you don't click on likes in places. People use your like information, and if you like very few things, they will know a whole lot about you. And so let other people like or not like, but it's better that you don't, if you want to keep some privacy. So I'm curious as to whether I'll like drop out of Facebook, after reading this book. It was kind of scary. All right.
All right. That's about all our time.
Thank you very much, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.